KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is a special broadcast of the California Report, coverage and analysis of Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State Address. I'm Scott Schaefer, and in just a few minutes, Governor Brown will deliver his first State of the State speech since taking office 4 weeks ago today. The last time he delivered a State of the State Address was nearly 30 years ago, in 1982, the first time he was governor. Jerry Brown will deliver his remarks at the state capitol before both houses of the legislature. And we are expecting he'll devote most, if not all, of his speech tonight to the state budget and the solutions that he's outlining for solving a massive deficit of more than $25 billion. Joining me now from the state capitol is our Sacramento Bureau Chief, John Myers. And John, we don't really need a speech from the governor to tell us that the state of the state is dire. Is there any reason for Jerry Brown to sugarcoat the state's fiscal picture tonight?
You know, Scott, I don't think so. Not only is there no reason to sugarcoat it, I think there's every reason to not. You know, the governor really needs the public, I think, to come to terms with the seriousness of the situation in California and in advance of what he hopes will be a June statewide special election, which he's trying to get the legislature to go along and call with him. The governor's budget, as we know, as we've seen over the last few weeks, is a painful mix of less spending and more taxes, and a $25 billion fix over the next 18 months. And so, no reason to sugarcoat it at all. And as a matter of fact, in the excerpts that we have just seen that have just been released, you know, the governor says the cuts are painful. He says that the parties have to come together. And on that special election issue, he says it would be, quote, unconscionable for the legislators to block a special election on these budget measures for June.
It seems that part of the plan on his part is to create that sense of urgency that not only does the legislature need to act by March to get this budget passed, but that voters then need to step up to the plate as well and do their part to avoid those even more draconian cuts that he's promising will happen if the budget isn't passed on time and there isn't a special election that is successful in terms of getting those measures passed, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, and keep in mind, too, I think that, you know, this is a late state of the state. We normally have them early in January. But that was by design. I mean, in talking to one of Brown's advisors a couple of weeks ago, they clearly wanted to wait until the budget was out, until he took office, and until everyone had had a chance to look at the budget and, frankly, complain about the budget, for the governor to have his first chance to frame the issue to the public. I mean, this is really the first time that the public gets an unfiltered chance to hear the governor they elected, listening tonight here on the radio. And so this is their chance to frame those issues to the public, to get the public to push the legislature forward. You know, a poll we saw last week, two-thirds of the public supports the special election in June. A lot of folks seem to like the plan that he's put forward of cuts and revenues. And so this is the governor's chance to start making the case.
And we are expecting the governor momentarily. Assembly Speaker John Perez is introducing the state constitutional officers, members of the California Supreme Court, and others. And then we'll wait for Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom to introduce the governor before we go to Jerry Brown. Let me bring in Thad Kauser, if I can, UC San Diego political science professor. And Professor Kauser, as I mentioned, Jerry Brown has been governor for about a month now. What kind of a month has it been?
It's been a month of painful realizations for him about just how bad the budget crisis is. And it's also been a month in which he's come up with a clear road for voters to follow him on if they will in a June special election. He's settled on a political strategy of trying to solve this budget half through tax increases or extending the current tax increases and half through spending cuts. He knows that he's got two big tasks to get there. He needs to convince legislators, at least five Republicans sitting in this room, to vote to put that package up to voters.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The governor is making his way now up to the podium. Being applauded, his wife Ann Gust and others standing to welcome him to give his first State of the State speech in, as I said, nearly 30 years. John Myers, we've seen in the last few days, last week, the governor making some symbolic gestures, eliminating a lot of cell phones for state workers, cutting the fleet of cars. What's the thinking behind that and the strategy of doing it just before the State of the State address?
I think it's very important. I mean, I think there's symbolism, in politics goes a long way. I mean, you know, we aren't talking about huge dollars, but I do think the governor seems to believe that if he's going to ask the voters to do more, he's going to to extend taxes that were set to expire, and he's going to make painful cuts, and he wants to show other things are being trimmed as well. He's cut his own staff of the governor's office. So the bottom line is, I think he thinks these are the things that the public wants to see, demands to see, before they consider the more painful alternatives.
Fed Kouser, anything to add to that?
Well, he's got to be a penny pincher if he's going to convince voters to give up their dollars in a tax increase. So he knows that this imagery is almost everything in this election.
And Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg now talking as they all get their moment to get a little bit of spotlight before the governor speaks. John Myers, earlier today in the San Francisco Chronicle, there were some highlights and summaries of past Brown State of the State speeches going all the way back to January 7th, 1976. One of the things that struck out for me, of course, was the brevity of some of these speeches. One was as short as 10 minutes, another 11, another one 9 minutes. So you've seen, I think, a copy of the speech. Do you have any sense of just how to the point and quick the governor is going to be tonight?
Well, we've only seen excerpts. We haven't seen the entire speech, but no one believes this is going to be a long speech. I mean, I think everyone thinks it's about the budget. Everyone thinks the governor is going to have to approach it in a very straightforward manner and that there's no reason for rhetorical flourish. And certainly, as you said, Jerry Brown has not been known for long speeches in this setting before. I think what's interesting about the past versus now is the different sense that people seem to have of Jerry Brown as governor at this point. You know, one analyst wrote today that he seems both more blunt and more mellow than the former version of Jerry Brown as governor, and that seems to be an interesting observation in the sense that, you know, the governor is at this stage in his political career, he's not looking beyond this job, and he seems to have a very clear sense that he's got to come in and change the process, which is what you heard him talking about the campaign, the political process, and that seems to be what he has done over the last few weeks. You have not seen him in public. He has been here in Sacramento, walking the halls, working legislators, talking to them, meeting with them.
And Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, a man not necessarily known for brevity, is speaking now and will introduce Governor Jerry Brown. We'll go to the governor as soon as he comes up to the podium. John Myers, talk briefly, if you would, about the change in tone. You alluded to it earlier just a moment ago that Governor Brown has been meeting with legislators, Republican legislators and Democrats. What else have you noticed in terms of the change in atmosphere at the state capitol in the last 4 weeks?
I think, you know, the main thing that we seem to have noticed a lot of is a more subdued nature of the executive branch. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was certainly not a man who was prone to subtlety and subdued gestures. And, you know, he liked the appearance of a powerful chief executive. Brown seems to be very, very low-key, under the radar. Again, he has met face-to-face with a lot of legislators. You've got legislators who say, you know, they never met with Arnold Schwarzenegger in this way, and Jerry Brown has already done it in the first few weeks. You see Brown in the hallways. He's accessible to the public. He goes down to the Capitol cafeteria to buy himself some lunch. He does not have that barrier between himself and the public in the same way that Arnold Schwarzenegger did. And people who know Jerry Brown says that is the real Brown. I mean, it does serve a purpose in these times where people want to be more frugal, austere, serious, low-key. But it is Brown.
And those who were here or who remember or know their history, the last time Jerry Brown was governor, he did have some of those symbolic flourishes. He drove an old beat-up Plymouth from the state car fleet. And we're probably going to see more of that in the coming weeks as Governor Jerry Brown, comes up to the podium to give his first State of the State speech. And we'll let John Myers, our Sacramento Bureau Chief, go and come back to you after the speech, John. Thank you.
Will do.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor Newsom, Speaker Perez, President Pro Tempore Steinberg, Senate Republican Leaders Dutton, Assembly Republican Leader Conway, constitutional officers, members of the legislature, members of the Supreme Court, distinguished guests, and my fellow citizens. First of all, I want to thank all of you in this chamber for the cordiality and goodwill that you've extended to my wife and me during these opening days of what will be an extraordinarily difficult and wrenching legislative session. I also have to add one more note. Actually, this is my 8th State of the State speech. I know that because alone among Californians and other people, I have actually read these State of the State speeches. And I've actually found where people mix up inaugurations and State of the State speeches. So in preparation for this, I went back and I read them. Tedious, sometimes sobering, and a challenge to do better. So with that prospect in mind, I continue. California faces a crisis that is real and unprecedented. Each of us will have to struggle with our conscience and our constituencies as we hammer out a sensible plan to put our state on a sound fiscal footing, honestly balance our budget, and position California to regain its historic momentum. Although our state's economy has started to recover, we'll not create the jobs we need unless we put our own financial house in order. It's absolutely essential that we do our work boldly and without delay. My intention is to make California again a leader in job creation, renewable energy, and state-of-the-art efficiency, innovation of all kinds, and a solid primary and secondary education system. Our universities are world-renowned, and I intend to see that they continue to enjoy the respect of students and scholars throughout the world. We also have to restructure our criminal justice system, carefully realign state and local government functions, and streamline state government itself. All this can happen if we find the courage and summon the will to tackle our budget deficit head-on and deal with it honestly and without any purpose of evasion. This is not the time for politics as usual. The stakes are too high. Our overall financial system, which came close to absolute breakdown, has not fully stabilized. Where we go from here, either more austerity or more stimulus, is hotly contested. Even the cause of the mortgage meltdown remains in dispute. Now, the voters are clearly telling us that our state and our nation are going in the wrong direction. Yet our two main political parties, both in Washington and California, are as far apart as I've ever seen them. Still, I know that politics is at the heart of democracy. It's the essence of our structure of freedom and the way in which we as a people make our collective decisions. We owe it to ourselves and to our forebears and to our children to rise to this occasion, do what is right, and regain the public trust. Kicking the can down the road by not owning an honest budget is simply out of the question. If you're a Democrat who doesn't want to make budget reductions in programs you fought for and deeply believe in, I understand that. If you're a Republican who's taken a stand against taxes, I understand where you're coming from. But this time, things are different. In fact, the people are telling us in their own way, they sense something is profoundly wrong. They see that their leaders are divided when they should be decisive and acting with clear purpose. We're still a very rich society. In 2 years alone, Californians will have added more than $100 billion to their personal income. Yet our state's credit rating is the lowest of 50 states. Unemployment is higher than the national average, and some journalists are calling California a failed state. The times call out for vision and for discipline. Discipline so that we live within the revenue which the state collects each year, and vision so that we rise above mere party, act as Californians first, and put our trust in the people. Under our form of government, it would be unconscionable to tell the electors of this state that they have no right to decide whether it's better to extend current tax statutes another 5 years or chop another $12 billion out of schools, public safety, our university, and our system of caring for the most vulnerable. Let me read you Article 2, Section 1 of the California Constitution. All political power is inherent in the people. Government is instituted for their protection, security, and benefit, and they have the right to alter or reform it when the public good may require. When democratic ideals and calls for the right to vote are stirring the imagination of young people in Egypt, in Tunisia, and other parts of the world, we in California can't say now is the time to block a vote of the people. In the ordinary course of things, matters of state concern are properly handled in Sacramento. But when the elected officials find themselves bogged down by deep differences which divide them, the only way forward is to go back to the people and seek their guidance. It's time for a legislative check-in with the people of California. And at this moment, and I want to see a few Republicans clapping on that, if you could. We'll build up as we get along here. Or if you want to block the people's right to vote, stand up and say, block that punt. At this moment of extreme difficulty, it behooves us to turn to the people and get a clear mandate on how we should proceed, either to extend the taxes, as I firmly believe, or to cut deeply into the programs from which, under federal law, we can still extract the sums required. Unfortunately, these would probably include elementary, middle, and high schools, the University of California, the California State University system, prisons and local public safety funding, and vital health programs. My plan to rebuild California requires a vote of the people. And frankly, I believe it would be irresponsible for us to exclude the people from this process. They have a right to vote on this plan. The state belongs to all of us, not just those in this chamber. Given the unique nature of the crisis and the serious impact our decisions will have on millions of Californians, whether it's more cuts, extend taxes, the voters deserve to be heard. Do I like the choices we face? No, I don't like them. But after serious study of the options left by a $25 billion deficit, the budget I proposed is the best that I can devise. If any of you, I mean that, if any of you have any other suggestions that you think are better, please share them with us. After all, we're in this together. In recent days, a lot has been made of the proposed elimination of redevelopment agencies. Mayors from cities, both large and small, have come to the Capitol and pressed their case that redevelopment is different from childcare, university funding, or grants to the aged, the disabled, and the blind. They base their case on the claim that redevelopment funds leverage other funds and create jobs. I certainly understand this because I saw redevelopment firsthand as a mayor of Oakland. But I also understand that redevelopment funds come directly from local property taxes that would otherwise pay for schools and core city and county services such as police and fire protection and care for the most vulnerable people in our society. So it's a matter of hard choices. And I come down on the side of those who believe that core functions of government must be funded first. But be clear, my plan protects current redevelopment projects and supports all bonded indebtedness of those redevelopment agencies. From the time I first proposed what I thought was a balanced budget approach to our deficit, both cuts and temporary extension of current taxes, dozens of groups affected by one or another of the proposed cuts have said we should cut somewhere else instead. Still others say we should not extend the current taxes but let them go away. So far, however, these same people have failed to offer even one alternative solution. And in all honesty, we have a right to get the alternative. This is a chamber of debate. It's a chamber of democracy. And let the different ideas come forth, but let them be ideas that measure up to the challenge before us. As I've said before, I've come here not to embrace delay or denial, but to get the job done. If you have solutions that are truly viable, by all means, present them. We need everyone's best thinking. And you can applaud on that. Republicans, you can applaud. Come on. best thinking. Wherever I look, I see difficult choices, and so do all of you. But I also see a bright future up ahead and a California economy that's on the mend. When we get our budget in balance, California will be in a strong position to take advantage of its many assets and its strategic location on the Pacific Rim. As the countries of Asia and south of our border continue to thrive and expand their trade, our state will play a leading role, as it always has, and will reap unimagined benefits. We have the inventors, the dreamers, the entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists, and a vast array of physical, intellectual, and political assets. We've been called the great exception because for generations, Californians have defied the odds and the conventional wisdom and prospered in totally unexpected ways. People keep coming here because of the dream that is still California. And once here, their determination and boundless energy feeds that dream and makes it grow. When I first came to Sacramento, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak had not yet invented their personal computer. There was no wind-generated electricity, and we didn't have the nation's most advanced building and appliance efficiency standards, as we later adopted. Of course, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, and Twitter did not exist, not even in someone's imagination. California has grown from less than $200 billion when I first came to this rostrum to now over $2 trillion expected this year. California has been on the move, a model, a miracle, and some kind of gift. Yes, I'll work with you on the issues from water and realignment to health care and prisons to agriculture, schools, environment, and transportation. We must also face the long-term challenge of ensuring that our public pensions are fair to both taxpayers and workers alike. Finally, at a time when more... So that's ambiguous. So either side can read into it whatever you want. In a sense that we want to welcome all possibilities and don't close off too many. Finally, at a time when more than 2 million Californians are out of work, we must search out and strip away any accumulated burdens or unreasonable regulations that stand in the way of investment and job creation. And I did say unreasonable. But let's not forget that job number one, make no mistake about it, is fixing our state budget and getting our spending in line with our revenue. Once we do that, the rest is going to be easy, at least easier, because we have learned to work together and earn back the respect and trust of the people we serve. I look forward to working with all of you, Republicans and Democrats, together to build this state of ours into what we know it can become again. Thank you.
Governor Jerry Brown giving his first State of the State address in this, his second go-round as governor. He spoke for just over 14 minutes. Didn't lay out many specifics, but did talk about the difficult choices ahead, saying that everyone's going to have to struggle with their conscience and their constituencies as we put the state back on track. You're listening to the State of the State address, a special broadcast from the California Report and KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer, and we are joined once again by our Sacramento Bureau Chief, John Myers, and also UC San Diego political science professor, Thad Kauser. John Myers, I know you have to run and do some work there at the state capitol, but before you leave, your impression of the speech?
Well, pretty much what we expected it to be, and probably what it needed to be, which was a straightforward, you know, acknowledgement of the state's problems, coupled with some promises to work together and some promises that, you know, that better days are ahead of the state. And I think that's all what the governor, you know, told us he wanted to do and has talked about what he wanted to do. What was interesting, though, is that even when the governor seemed to offer the olive branch lines to the Republican Party in this chamber, pension reform, regulatory reform, he got almost no applause from that side of the aisle. And that's interesting. You heard him several times say, it's okay, you can applaud to a member.
Even encouraging them to please, please applaud.
Exactly. And yet it was though they were sitting here watching something that was slightly amusing or bemusing, and they just kind of sat there. And so I think that is a fundamental challenge. And I will say that I think the real key point to this speech is the really, you know, laying it down very strongly that the legislature needs to let the voters weigh in on this budget proposal, because the legislature has to go along to help him call the special election for June with these tax extensions. Republicans have seemed as though they're not willing to vote to have that election. The governor, in no uncertain terms, said it would be unconscionable, and it would be basically a blocking of democracy if they did not go along.
Even mentioning the specter of Egypt and Tunisia, the democracy movement stirring there, and saying now is not the time to block a vote of the people. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. John, I know you've got to go get some reaction to the governor's speech. We'll let you go do that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
And as I said, we're also joined by Thad Kauser, UC San Diego political science professor. And Thad Kauser, as I said, right after the speech, not a lot of specifics at all. Maybe that's not what State of the State addresses are for, after all. That's really what the budget is. But what was your impression of the speech, what he might have accomplished, and what he needs to accomplish coming out of today?
Well, in his lack of specifics, this speech doesn't surprise anyone who's been watching Governor Brown the first month of his administration, but it's very different from what we're used to hearing in State of the State addresses. So governors always lay out this long laundry list of the bills that they want, the proposals that they have. Looking back at, you know, Governor Brown's father, Pat Brown, had one speech with 38 different bill ideas. This had zero. So I think in doing that, what this Governor Brown is saying is that we have really one challenge that counts, and that's the budget. And I think he tried to pivot the debate over the budget from the tough choices of spending cuts and tax increases that Sacramento and voters may have to make, and instead elevate the discussion to a discussion about political theory. How should we run our democracy? By directly involving the people. And he even quoted the California Constitution to that effect. So I think he was trying to make a principled case for a special election rather than focus on the tough medicine that he's offered in his more detailed budget of a few weeks ago.
And I want to bring another voice in now. Jim Brolte is the former Senate Republican leader. He's also a consultant, a Republican campaign consultant, political consultant. Jim Brolte, good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
So what did you think of the speech? What did you like about it? What was missing?
Well, I thought it was a great set of remarks by the governor. I thought he did exactly what he needed to do, was lay out the case as to why he thought there ought to be a special election and let the voters decide what they want to do relative to taxes or cuts. You could tell that was well received by the Democrats in the chamber, and my guess is it got the Republicans in the chamber squirming.
Why do you say that?
Well, you know, democracy is a core identity of the people of California. So the Republicans will not have a good answer to not allowing the voters to make this choice. My guess is the Republicans will have to find a way of pivoting and saying, okay, well, in addition to giving them the choice of taxes, we have to give them the choice of a number of things, perhaps pension reform, perhaps a spending limit. You know, I think Republicans' only option is to call the governor and frankly raise him, say, fine, we agree we ought to go to the people. We've got a couple of ideas on what the people ought to have a chance to vote on as well.
So you're saying that as part of their agreement to put his ideas on the budget, there would be additional things that would go on a special election ballot?
I would be stunned if Republicans in the legislature allowed the taxes to go on the ballot without other issues. I would just be surprised.
And you think something like a spending cap, and what else do you think might be in the goodie bag?
You know, well, look, at the same time the voters rejected the taxes that the governor wants back on the ballot, they rejected a spending limit. My guess is some Republicans will try to entertain that discussion. I know from my discussions with Republicans in the legislature, some of them think a spending limit ought to be on the pension reform ought to be on the ballot as well. So, my view is Republicans will not be able to flatly reject the governor's proposal. They will have to have a counter proposal. And my guess is the counter proposal will be additional items on the ballot.
As you know, there's a lot of pressure coming from places like Grover Norquist, who gets a lot of Republican candidates to sign this no tax pledge. Do you? And he has recently told Republicans in the state legislature that even voting to allow the people to decide on this extension of these taxes would be violating that no tax pledge. Do you think that's a viable argument? Do you agree with that argument?
Well, first of all, there are two parts to that. Do I think that putting on the ballot and allowing the voters to choose whether or not they want to extend tax increases, do I think that's voting for a tax increase? No, I don't. That said, I'm not sure Republican primary voters will share my opinion on that. What Grover Norquist, I believe, has said is the pledge that they signed said not only would they support oppose tax increases, but they would oppose anything that makes it easier to pass tax increases. So Grover is probably correct when he says the pledge they signed would be violated. But they signed a pledge that was very, very specific that they wouldn't take any action. So
we'll wait to see. And one other just quick question, that might they be influenced by the fact that we're going to be having open primaries for the first time in California, and that perhaps a vote against even allowing people to avoid those budget cuts that the governor is threatening, that could be difficult, make life difficult for them in a Republican primary if there's a more moderate Republican running against them?
I think the open primary certainly shuffles the deck. And any Republican or Democrat who believes that the way to guarantee their reelection is by acting the way that they have over the last two or three or four years doesn't understand the impact of the open primary.
All right. Jim Brolte, former Senate Republican leader and now a political consultant here in California. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's go now. We have responses to the governor's speech from the two Republican leaders in the Assembly and the State Senate. Let's begin with Assembly Republican Leader Connie Conway. She is a Republican from Tulare.
Hello. I'm Assembly Republican Leader Connie Conway. As Californians, we are blessed to live in a state that in many ways is the best in the world. Yet we also face challenges that threaten both our way of life and the future of our beloved state. We are struggling with the nation's second highest unemployment rate and a budget deficit that is out of control. That's discouraging, but also challenging. The pioneers who settled our state never were deterred by the obstacles they faced. We simply have to forge ahead, as they did. Tonight, Governor Brown put forward his ideas to solve California's most urgent problems. Assembly Republicans stand ready to work with the governor and the majority party to achieve our common goal, getting California back on track. We share the governor's goal of passing an honest and on-time budget. It is our hope that Governor Brown focuses on cutting spending and on long-term reform. We need to break away from the failed status quo. That means rejecting higher taxes, attacking wasteful spending, and doing away with the policies and programs that got us into this mess in the first place. Will that be easy? No. We have a $25 billion deficit. But living within our means is the right thing to do. It's what families and businesses already do. At churches and grocery stores, I meet people who are coping with our economy in a sensible manner. They are hardworking, industrious, and innovative Californians who don't care about political games. They don't have a sense of panic nor a sense of dread. They simply want big government to become responsible, reasonable government. We must provide essential services, but we must do so with efficiency and frugality. We must cut spending, and we must do it now. The people have made it clear they don't want to pay higher taxes. Voters have rejected every tax increase on the last two statewide ballots. It's time for Sacramento to finally listen to the people. Republicans stand united as the only line of defense for California taxpayers. We believe the best solution to help close our deficit is not by raising taxes, but by creating private sector jobs. That is done by lifting regulations and by reducing frivolous lawsuits. For far too long, the legislature has strangled our economy by imposing mandates, regulations, and taxes. It's no wonder that companies have been leaving California for other states. For the past 6 years, CEO Magazine has ranked our state as the worst place to do business in the entire nation. We cannot allow that to continue. Let's make life more simple by focusing on what's important. Let's maintain our parks, roads, schools, and public safety. Let's create jobs by helping business owners instead of hurting them. And let's balance the budget. Remember, with more people earning a living and paying their fair share of modest taxes, we can make our state great again. We must also rein in soaring public pension costs and make government programs run more cost-effectively. As simple as that sounds, it won't be easy, because years and years of poor decisions precede us. But we can learn from those mistakes. To do so, Democrats and Republicans must work together to restore the people's faith in their government. Assembly Republicans offer our hand of cooperation. We look forward to working across party lines to cut the deficit, encourage new hiring, end the tax and spend mentality with true common sense. I hope you will be part of this movement against our broken system. Call or email your legislators to express your views. Together, we can do this. Thank you.
And again, that was Assembly Republican Leader Connie Conway, a Republican from Tulare. She represents a long swath of the San Joaquin Valley. You're listening to a special broadcast of the California Report, our coverage of the State of the State address tonight by Governor Jerry Brown. And by the way, you can go to kqed.org/newsfix for a live chat and a live blog on the State of the State address. Again, that address is kqed.org/newsfix. Thad Kauser from UC San Diego, do you hear either in Connie Conway's remarks or the way in which the Republicans reacted to Governor Brown's speech, do you hear a sincere hand being reached out of bipartisanship tonight?
Well, I think that the theme repeated over and over again is that pension reform is a high priority to Republicans. And it's also something that, Jerry Brown talked about when he was running for this for the governorship, and he's been largely silent on in the first month of his administration. So that may be a place where the governor and Republicans, and he needs five Republicans to vote to put on the ballot his budget solution. That might be an area they could find common ground. And also, we will have a spending cap that was part of the last budget deal that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger brokered, an idea for a spending cap that will be before voters on whatever ballot comes next for voters. So there are two areas there that there may be some agreement across party lines.
All right. And now we're going to hear the other Republican response tonight, the Senate Republican leader, Bob Dutton, from Riverside and San Bernardino counties.
I came to Sacramento with the hope of solving problems and making California prosperous again. I am encouraged that Governor Brown seems genuinely committed to solving the significant challenges our state faces. California has the second highest unemployment rate in the nation, now at 12.5%. And we continue to deal with a budget crisis that this year alone stands at $28 billion. I applaud the governor for his no-nonsense approach to California's challenges. For example, although mostly symbolic, he's right to take away thousands of non-essential cell phones from state workers. However, Governor Brown's budget proposal will not restore California's economy. Government must spend your tax dollars efficiently and effectively. That will require real and permanent spending reductions, not more taxes. Only one-third of the governor's proposed budget includes actual spending reductions. In this budget, there are more than $4.5 billion in so-called cuts that are really nothing more than an accounting shell game. He's simply moving money from one account to another. The governor is also asking voters to extend the recent tax hikes. Higher taxes didn't solve the problem 2 years ago. It won't solve it now. Taxpayers already said no to a two-year tax extension in 2009. Why would they now vote to tax themselves for five more years? And most importantly, this budget does nothing to help the more than 2 million unemployed Californians get back to work. The only way to put an end to this budget debacle is for government to get out of the way and let the business community create and retain jobs. More people working means revenue for the state. More revenue for the state means the state can provide needed services. The governor has proposed a good starting point, My Republican colleagues and I look forward to working with him in the weeks ahead to get California back on the road to recovery.
That is Senate Republican leader Bob Dutton from Riverside and San Bernardino counties, saying that government needs to just get out of the way and allow the economic recovery to happen without higher taxes. Thad Kauser, your thoughts about that message and what Jim Brulte said earlier when he said he doesn't think Republicans can simply say we're not going to allow voters to weigh in on this.
Well, I think both Republican leaders in the legislature clearly drew a line and are clearly opposed to tax increases being part of this budget solution. And I think one that shows us that this partisan polarization in Sacramento that we all bemoan, that Arnold Schwarzenegger bemoaned, that Jerry Brown bemoaned in his speech, is something that's really deeply ingrained, that the parties represent voters that really think in different ways about how to solve these solutions. So does that mean that Sacramento can never find common ground? I think the question will be whether Jerry Brown, not can he find every Republican in Sacramento to agree with him, but can he find a few of those votes? And this was a speech that he gave that was not aimed – it wasn't aimed at the mass audience and watching on television or listening on the radio. It was squarely aimed at the people sitting in front of him and aimed at finding a few people who he could pressure into giving voters a choice about whether they want to vote for tax increases.
Of all the things that the governor has proposed, I don't think anything has gotten more criticism than his notion of eliminating redevelopment agencies. That has been a source of funding for job creation and development in inner cities. And we're joined now by the executive director of the League of Cities in California, Chris McKenzie. Mr. McKenzie, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
So before I get to the specifics of the governor's speech, such as they were, what's your argument? What's your quick argument against eliminating redevelopment agencies as the governor's proposing?
You know, it comes down to just a few basic things. One is redevelopment agencies create over 300,000 jobs a year, most of them construction jobs in the private sector that pay good wages and that generate $2 billion in revenues for the state and local government. And number two, that it's illegal. The voters of California have said that these funds should be spent at the community level for these kinds of infrastructure and affordable housing investments, and they shouldn't be used to help balance the state budget.
But presumably couldn't the voters undo that on the ballot?
Of course. The voters are free to undo anything, but as recently as last November, they spoke, 61% of them said the state should balance the state budget with state funds. And that requires real revenues, state revenues. It requires real cuts in the state budget, just like cities and counties all over the state are making very deep cuts and laying off employees, cutting vital services in order to make sure the budget's balanced.
And the governor did specifically address this question. Let's play a short clip from his speech, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
So it's a matter of hard choices. And I come down on the side of those who believe that core functions of government must be funded first. But be clear, my plan protects current redevelopment projects and supports all bonded indebtedness of those redevelopment agencies.
Chris McKenzie from the League of Cities, do those assurances make you feel any better at all?
Now, I'm sure the governor has the intentions that he stated. We, of course, haven't seen any details, but that is not going to protect the 300,000 jobs a year. That's not going to generate the $2 billion in revenue to the state and local governments that are necessary to pay for those vital services. You know, this is really the equivalent, I like to tell people, of a farmer who's getting ready for the next season and decides to eat the corn, the seed corn that he or she needs in order to generate the new crop. He talked a lot about the importance of jobs and growing the economy. We share that goal with him. We think it's vital in order to help California recover. You can't cut off the most important tool that you have for doing that at the local level and expect to see growth. And we strongly disagree with it.
Your point is that the redevelopment agencies are a real economic engine. And yet there's a new report or a relatively new report out from the Legislative Analyst. And it says, and I'm quoting here, there's no reliable evidence that redevelopment agencies attract business or improve economic development overall. And they go on to say that it may shift economic development from one city to another, but there's really no overall increase statewide. What's your reaction to that?
The reaction is, if you read the report carefully, the only study that's quoted is over 13 years old. There are no other citations to any other studies, and I would challenge any of our listeners who are familiar with the Mission Bay area of San Francisco, if they're familiar with downtown if they're familiar with downtown San Diego or downtown San Jose, and they think about the very, very important changes that have occurred there. Over 90,000 units of affordable housing have been constructed with these funds. Very important investments, and infrastructure has been built. Schools have been built. Fire stations have been built. Streets have been built. And, you know, the governor talked a lot, and I'm glad he did, about the importance of the right to vote and respecting the Constitution. The voters last November said that the Constitution prohibits taking redevelopment funds and other local government funds to balance the state budget. And ironically and amazingly, that's exactly what he's proposed.
All right. Chris McKenzie, Executive Director of the League of Cities, and undoubtedly we'll be having this conversation for the next several months. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, the fundamental problem, of course, that California faces is the economy and the sudden drop of revenue that happened over the past several years. And joining us now is economist Chris Thornburg. He is a principal with Beacon Economics. Good to have you with us, Mr. Thornburg.
Nice to be here.
Let me ask you, how much can a governor do one way or the other, whether it's with tax policy or spending cuts, other tweaks? How much can a governor do to fix this fundamental underlying problem, which is we're still coming out of a recession?
Well, the answer, of course, is none at all without the help of the legislative bodies. In fact, what I heard him do in this very short, very point to the speech was, I'm proposing a way to balance the budget. If you don't like it, give me a better solution. And the problem is no one can do that. I mean, the Republicans keep saying we won't raise taxes, but then they don't explain exactly where are you going to get the pounds of flesh from? And of course, the Democrats say you can't cut spending this way, but he says, well, where are we going to get the money from? So in a sense, it seems to me that he's really put this at the feet of the legislators.
So are you saying that he in fact has come up with the best plan, and it's up to the others to find? In other words, if he gets his way, is that really a road to recovery?
He has a plan. His point is, if you're going to disagree with his plan, come up with a better plan. So I'm not sure if he qualified anywhere in there whether his plan was the best. But, you know, I think it's an aggressive plan. It gets us to where we need to be. And he's obviously going at some of the base things here, such as the CRA, which is just being discussed, and, of course, keeping those tax increases in place, things like that. You know, the both parties have a problem with that, but nobody has a better solution.
So are you saying then that that a balance, he's got roughly $12 billion in cuts and $12 billion in extending, you know, tax revenue. Are you saying that really, from an economist's point of view, is really the best way to lead the state back to recovery, as opposed to balancing it more with higher taxes or more with cuts?
Yeah, let's be cautious here. The state's economy is recovering. The national economy is recovering. The fact is, you look at the numbers, economic output is increasing at a pretty substantial pace, both here in California as well as across the United States. The labor markets are starting to turn. We're still obviously in the back end of that, but labor markets are still starting to turn. But nonetheless, the economy is healing. And the budget problem is a problem for state government. It's not a problem or a solution for the ongoing recovery, per se. Keep in mind that what we're talking about here is a $20, $25 billion gap. That number adds up to something on the order of a little over 1% of the overall state economy. There is nothing that says that this budget solution is a necessary linchpin in the recovery, because the recovery is already underway.
And so you're saying that if it was skewed one way or the other, either with more cuts or more revenue, that it wouldn't really have that big an effect on the recovery one way or the other?
Yeah, not so much at this point in time. But I will say in general that clearly tax increases in the short run are less painful than cutting services. Particularly at this point. The one big qualification there, of course, is very often when you go through the first couple rounds of expenditure cutting, very often because the government isn't inherently competitive. They don't have competition from other governments, per se, that force them to constantly innovate. A lot of time, governments tend to build up lots of slack in the system. They don't put in cost efficiencies because, frankly, they don't have to. And it takes a budget cut or two to get them to start putting those efficiencies into place. But those efficiencies only go so far. At some point in time, there's no more efficiencies. You start cutting into the real flesh, and that's when it starts having a painful impact on the economy. The question is, has the state gone over that point? And my feeling is, and this is purely intuitive, it'd be hard to sit down and actually do the study, but my feeling is the cuts that have gone over the last couple of years really have squeezed most of the excess out of the system in the short run. It's hard for me to see how we can find many more efficiencies right now.
All right. Christopher Thornburg from Beacon Economics, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Thad Kauser, this notion that the sky is falling, in a sense, which is part of the governor's message, I'm wondering how effective you think that will be with voters, because for the past several years, we've heard Governor Schwarzenegger and others say that we're going to have severe cuts unless we can, you know, figure out a way to be more efficient or raise taxes. And yet they've found a way in many cases to sort of paper it over with floating a bond or one-time fixes, sort of a little bit of smoke and mirrors. Does that leave the governor with a little bit of inherited lack of credibility that he needs to restore with the voters?
Right. We're the state that's cried wolf to voters many times in the past few years because at the end of the day, we haven't passed honest budgets. We've kicked the can down the road. Even in good years, we didn't pass budgets that were really in balance. And we knew that whenever a national economy took a downturn, the state would have a giant deficit. So this governor knows that he can't merely threaten doom and gloom if voters don't go along with him. So instead of saying the sky's falling, he was talking about the sky's being the limit for California. He was talking about what California can be if we fix this problem and spending very little time warning of what might become of California if we fail to solve it. He's decided that voters would feel like they're held for ransom if he said, look, if you don't pass these tax increases, I'm going to let your kids out of school 6 weeks early. That may indeed happen at the end of the day. But I think Governor Brown knows that voters just don't trust those kind of doom and gloom messages from Sacramento. They want to see why you'll get some gain if they experience pain. And he had a more positive tone in this speech than I was expecting.
Well, let's bring in someone now who may not be so reluctant to talk about the pain that would come with additional budget cuts. I'm talking about Senator Mark Leno, a Democrat from San Francisco, who chairs the Senate Budget and Fiscal Review Committee. Senator Leno, good to have you with us.
Scott, great to be with you. Thank you.
So tell me what you heard tonight. Did you feel that, A, the governor is on the right track? And then, B, is there going to be some reaching across the aisle from the Republicans to the Democrats?
Sure. He was very succinct. He was to the point. He made the argument that voters see the legislature as divisive at a time when we need to be decisive. His words, he said, it's also a time for discipline as well as vision, that we're all going to have to make cuts that are going to be very painful personally and politically, but the money is not there. We had projections of a $125 billion general fund budget for the 11-12 budget year, and we're actually at $85 billion. So we are a shrinking government as we speak, and we have to now match our expenditures to our fallen revenues. And that's going to mean very painful cuts. Real people are going to suffer, and it's not going to be pleasant. But at the same time, if we don't get to the ballot, and if voters do not support not raising anyone's taxes, but merely maintaining current tax levels for another 5 years, the second round of $12 billion in cuts will cause significant damage to the infrastructure that made California once great. And I'm talking about the infrastructures of public education, access to affordable quality higher education, public safety institutions that keep our communities safe, and health care and social services that provide us a quality of life which we have come to expect.
And Senator Leno, before we let you go, question, what do you think Democrats might be willing to give to Republicans in order to get the few votes that you need in the Assembly and the Senate to get this budget passed and to get these measures on the ballot? For example, would you consider a spending cap, which many Republicans are for, or pension reform?
Well, there's already a spending cap that the legislature has placed on the ballot for 2012. We've already significantly reformed our pension system with a vote in October. That's, of course, prospective for new hires. There will be ongoing debate and discussions, and I'm sure resolution of pension reform, but that won't balance this year's budget. And I'm going to change the frame, Scott. I'm going to suggest that the couple of votes of Republicans we need at each house to get us to the ballot so that voters will have a say as to their own future should not be because they're going to successfully extort anything from Democrats from a long laundry list of wishes, but it's because their own constituents fighting for community college campuses to stay open, for UC and CSU funding, for public safety institutions, the sheriff and police in their districts, and for those who value K through 12 education are going to be pounding on their door and asking, are you really out of your mind? You're not going to let us have a vote
in
this?
And that obviously is what will be playing out in California between now and June, assuming that there is a special election. Senator Mark Leno, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott.
Senator Mark Leno, the chair of the Senate Budget and Fiscal Review Committee. And just real quickly, I want to bring in John Kupal, president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Mr. Kupal, is there any reason for Republicans to compromise with this governor and get his budget passed quickly and allow the voters to decide on these extending of taxes?
Well, first of all, I think the voters have already spoken with the overwhelming rejection of Proposition 1A back in May of 2009.
But polls indicate that they're a little more open to it this time.
No, I mean, that PPIC poll had a generic question about the governor's budget, but the actual questions on the very tax increases he's seeking, income taxes, sales taxes, vehicle license tax, would overwhelmingly go in defeat even under the PPIC poll. So, you know, it's clear where the voters are. But I will say this. If there is a deal to put tax increases on the ballot, then if you really want to let the voters decide, there ought to be the choice of tax decreases of an equal amount on the same ballot. And that, in our view, would give voters the most amount of flexibility and choices, either increase taxes, keep them the same, or decrease taxes.
All right. John Kupal, president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
And thanks to all of our guests tonight, including Thad Kauser, director of the California Constitutional Reform Project at Stanford, along with State Senator Mark Leno, Jim Brulte, John Kupal, as I mentioned, with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Chris McKenzie, executive director for the League of Cities, and Chris Thornburg, principal of Beacon Economics. You can hear more analysis of the governor's speech tomorrow morning on the California Report, carried on most of these stations. And don't forget, for a live chat and live blog on the state of the state, go to kqed.org/newsfix. Again, that's kqed.org/newsfix. You've been listening to a special broadcast of the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. The director for this special broadcast is Susie Rocho. Our engineer is Seal Muller. Coverage of the governor's State of the State address was produced by Polly Stryker. Our engineering team includes Dan Manzer, Larry Wood, and Monte Carlos. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the members of KQED Public Radio.